This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the Gateless Gate, Master Wu Min. Number 26, two monastics rolled up the bamboo blinds. The koan. The monastics had gathered in the hall to hear the great Fayen of Qingliang give taisho before the midday meal. Fayen pointed to the bamboo blinds, and at this, two monastics went to the blinds and rolled them up alike. Fayen said, "One has it, the other has not." Woman's commentary. Tell me, which one has it and which one has not? If you have your Dharma eye opened at this point, then you'll know how Master Fayen failed. Be that as it may, you're strictly warned against arguing about has and has not. The poem. When they are rolled up, bright and clear is the great emptiness. The great emptiness does not yet come up to our teaching. Why don't you cast away emptiness and everything? Then it's so lucid and perfect that even the wind does not pass through. So we're concluding an introductory retreat. And so I want to say a little bit about the koan. Throughout all of Buddhist practice, in particular meditation, there are different practices that have been developed and taught, beginning with the Buddha. That help to develop our compassion, our concentration, our samadhi, and our insight, our wisdom. And so everything that, as I've said during the weekend, everything that we do in practice is in service to this path of awakening, to alleviating suffering and understanding the real nature of things, self and other. And so for so many centuries, meditation being such a central practice, it's been developed and taken up in these various ways, which are not that different, really. They're fundamentally, essentially the same in those terms of their principles and even in a certain way how they function. But they direct the student in different ways that can be helpful. And so there are practices that are particularly helpful in the beginning, when we're developing our meditation. There are practices that are helpful given the different person who is practicing them. So their state of mind, how they work with their mind, how they work with their life. Because skillfulness, which is such an important part of Buddhist teachings and practice, that upaya, the skillful means of compassion, is based in wisdom, so it's compassion that's based in a real understanding of how things are. But skillfulness is what allows it to be received by the student. And so various practices exist to sort of bring that skillfulness to students, different students being different, and to a student at different points along their own journey. So the koan, in essence, is a part of that. So it's a way of doing zazen. It's a way of bringing our attention directly into a point of focus, which is the koan itself. And it is both very powerful and it's dangerous, as most things that have power are. And so it really has to do with how we use it. And so koans are questions. Sometimes they're passages from sutras. They're dialogues. They're a moment in the life of a community, such as this one. And the student takes up the koan, within which every koan is some question or something that is to be resolved. And the resolution is not an answer in an ordinary sense, but bringing the student to a state of consciousness, a state of awakening, that awakens them to the point or the dharma of that koan. Some koans are very direct. some koans, in a sense, intentionally obfuscate. They create a pit that the student almost certainly will fall into. And that those pits are basically the things in our mind, the things in our lives that we get hooked in. Some koans are very subtle, and that can be their challenge, is the subtlety of the koan. And some koans kind of hit you on the head, kind of like this one, in the sense that what it's, even though it's a very powerful koan, it's a very profound koan, what it's pointing to is, in a sense, kind of obvious. One has it and one has not. And because of that can also be where we get caught up, because it seems clear, seems obvious. And so we go, because that door seems wide open. That must be the door. That must be what it's about. And all of this really is a way of helping us to encounter just such things in our life, things that may seem one way, but are not, things that are subtle and so we miss, things that have to do with words and meaning that we get caught up in, so that we can free ourselves. Fayen was one of a very important master in China. He lived around in the early 10th century. A whole school of Zen developed out of his teaching. And the story of him coming to his teacher, Dijan, is interesting. He was traveling with some other monks. They were on a pilgrimage. And they encountered a snowstorm, and so they gathered up at Dijan's place to wait out the storm. And after the storm passed, they were getting ready to leave. And Dijan, accompanied them to the main gate to bid them off. And so as they were saying farewell, Dijan at the gate said, "I've heard you monks talking during your stay here several times that the three realms are only mind and the myriad dharmas are only consciousness." So he's basically quoting a passage from a sutra that these monks must have been talking about. And then Dijan pointed to a rock lying on the ground by the gate and said, "So do you say that this rock is inside or outside of your mind, if the three worlds are nothing but mine?" And Fayen said, "Inside my mind." And Dijan said, "How can a pilgrim carry such a rock in your mind while you're walking?" And Fayen didn't know how to respond. And so he put down his bags and said, "Can I study with you?" The others left. It's very interesting. Right? They all heard the same thing, but they didn't hear it the same. And so every day for a month, it says, Dijan went into Fayen and spoke about the Dharma, demonstrating his understanding. And every day, Dijan would say, "The Buddha Dharma isn't like that." And finally, Fayen came in one day and says, "I've run out of words and ideas." And Dijan said, "If you want to talk about Buddha Dharma, if you want to know Buddha Dharma, everything you see embodies it." And at that, Fayen was enlightened. While he was teaching, one day a student asked him, "What is the ultimate truth? What is the real truth?" And Fayen said, "First, I pray you will live it. Second, I pray you will live it." Indeed. In the Buddha Dharma, that's what it's about, living it. Our lives are too short to play games, to just engage this profound practice as an intellectual, sort of philosophical, dinner conversation kind of thing. At least for me. I pray you will live it. I pray I will live it. It's about living it. That is the essence of the Buddha Dharma. That's what it was for the Buddha. Everything he did, everything he taught, was to help in small and large ways to bring whoever was interested to liberation. Dzogchen said, everything you see embodies it. We hear that, the Dharma of the 10,000 things. Everything is teaching. Everything is a gate. What does that mean? How is that so? If that's true, then why aren't we all enlightened? If that's true, then why are we all at peace? And so in a sense, we have to begin with this everything. Everything embodies it. The Faith Mind began the great poem, that's a very important poem teaching in the Zen tradition, the Faith Mind poem, starts, the great way is not difficult. This is the ultimate truth. We enter into practice, our lives are difficult. We're trying to address in some deeper way the difficulty not only of our lives, but of our lives. And we're met with, the great way is not difficult. This is the ultimate truth. Then why is there so much sorrow? The next part of that first line is just be free of picking and choosing. Just be free of rejecting and indulging. And that really is the path, the middle way. To be free of rejecting and indulging is like a great illumination in the dark of night, in which nothing changes and nothing is the same. Change, we interpret, we sort of perceive as something that is solid and fixed and has its own essence, has a self, changes into something new that is solid and fixed and has its own self. So we come in and we think we're going to change, sort of get rid of or transform ourselves from something into a new something. And we're going to use something to do that. Call it Dharma, call it Buddha, call it Sangha, call it Zazen. And that's part of the illumination. The Faith Mind says, the changes that occur in the empty world we call real only because of our delusion. The changes that seem to occur, and yet all is impermanent. Everything is in a state of change, but what does change mean? When nothing has any inherent quality, when there is no self, but there's only this moment unfolding, arising and departing, that what we call life is a ceaseless, for lack of a better word, process. And so Fayin, gathering the Sangha together to offer a Teisho, just simply points over to the window, and two monastics jump up and roll the blinds up exactly the same. And looking at them, he said, one has it and one has not. And of course, the question is, why? Why does one have it? One has it is enlightenment, realization. One is clear, one is not. One is enlightened, one is deluded. One is free, one is not. One is bound. But Fayin, this great master, certainly knows that all things have no inherent existence. He certainly realized freedom from right and wrong, from the tyranny of living in a world in which everything is reduced to success and failure. So why does he say this? The Faith Mind says, if there's even a trace of this and that, of right and wrong, the mind's essence, your original mind, your original peace, is lost in confusion. And that's what makes this koan so powerful, is because we live in a world immersed in the sense of right and wrong. And right and wrong is just, represents all dualities. Heaven and hell, deserving and undeserving, worthy and unworthy, smart and dull, progressing, regressing. We chant in the identity of relative and absolute, do not judge by any standard. You know, think about just going through the course of the day, think about any moment in which some subtle sense of dis-ease comes up, which is most moments, if we pay attention. And if you really connect with that, what's going on? You know, what's the voice of that? I want something, but I don't have it. If I only had this, then it would be okay. If this would just go away, then it would be okay. Then I would be okay. Why is this happening to me? How can I possibly be okay? How can I possibly meditate? How can I possibly be compassionate as long as this is? When this ends, then I'll be good. When I get through this, then I'll be good. Our tombstone could read, almost got there. It was just around the corner. Every standard, do not judge by any standard. Every standard is a human construct, a form of measuring. And once we're measuring, then we're going to compare. That's what we measure, to compare. And based on that, then we include, we exclude, we elevate, we denigrate. Every action that causes suffering takes place within a mind that is imposing some standard of measurement and impute into it a subjective view into that which is being measured. Do I want it? Do I not want it? Do I make friends with it? Do I destroy it? All of this based in what we call our karmic dispositions, which are reside within us. They are very much of our own doing, our actions, our thoughts, our words, our beliefs, our views, but also that is so completely mingled with the thoughts and beliefs and views and intentions of our world, our society, our groups. In the very beginning of Zazen instruction, we say when something arises, do not judge it. Do not judge by any standard. Do not bring any measurement to this. How many of us actually trust that, really? And even if we trust it, do we do it, right? It's such a habit, it's such a strong habit. We judge everything. Just tell me, this last period of Zazen, was it a good period of Zazen or a bad period of Zazen? You know, you already know. And that is our misery, right? In that we create our sadness, our frustration, our insufficiency, our inadequacy, or our amazingness. So why does Fei Yan, knowing all of this, say one has it and one has not? In the commentary, Shibayama says, if there is no distinction of right and wrong in the same action, then why did Fei Yan say? If all things return to the one, or if all things are empty of any inherent quality, why did he say one is right and one is wrong, one has and one has not? If there is a distinction of right and wrong in the same action, then what kind of right and wrong did he see? And so, almost always when somebody is working on this, they'll come in and they'll say, well, one monk was mindfully rolling up the blinds, and the other was not. How do you know that? How do you know that? The koan isn't telling you that. And that's the basis of the koan. It is complete, it is sufficient, it tells you everything you need to know. But then we project because we realize, oh, well, it's, you know, clearly one was rolling them up differently. Fei Yan, great master, was able to realize that. Or maybe he knew both students, so he knows one has and one has not. But that's all projection. We're just making this shit up, right? Like we do. Do not judge by any standard. And so to practice the koan is to enter into it. You're the one rolling the blind. Very simple. You just jump up. You're just taking care of something. Innocent. Innocent. And suddenly the teacher calls out. One has it and one has not. What arises? Insecurity? Confidence? Anger? Embarrassment? And what Buddhism teaches is whatever arises, the seeds are already there. The self is arising. That's what we need to see, that this is the self arising in the form of this thought, this emotion. Meanwhile, Dzogchen is calling out, everything you see embodies it. And so the question is, insecurity arises. Where is the insecurity? Embarrassment arises. Where is the embarrassment? Arrogance arises. Where is the arrogance? Is it in the rolling up of the blinds? Is it in the blinds? Is it in Fayen? Is it in you? Can you locate it? Or maybe you're sitting in the hall, thankful that you're not the one rolling up the blinds. Right? Looking at it from some distance. But then very quickly you think, but one of them has it, one has not. Do I have it? Something creeps in. A Tibetan master I was reading recently said, the pain that you feel in that moment is real. The story is not. And there are years of training, years of practice in that one simple statement. The middle way doesn't deny right and wrong. The Buddha said, I talked about this on Friday night, we are fundamentally moral beings. We are seeking peace. All of us, not always in the right way. Sometimes in ways that are so twisted that you can't even recognize it. But all of us hunger for that. It's part of our being. And all of us are acting. We're all impacting ourselves and others. There's no exemption. So there's this deep, deep sense of moral truth in the Dharma, because it's in us. It's the world we live in. It's the world we create. So it absolutely doesn't deny right and wrong. So then why is Fayen creating a world of right and wrong in which to get trapped? And so as we examine that self arising, right? I have it, I don't have it. I'm a good student, I'm not a good student. I'm a good person, I'm not a good person. That's the self arising. Examine that. And examine that at the root. Go to the root. The Buddha said it's at the root that we transform, we turn that basis and free ourselves. The perceptions that seem to appear in the empty world, we call real, we call absolute, only because of our delusion. So the Buddha said there is a universal sense of right and wrong, wholesome and unwholesome, skillful and unskillful. Based on whether an action, a word, a thought, an intention, a desire is arising from and is encouraging greed, anger, delusion, pride, jealousy, hatred, destruction, life destruction. Whether it's creating division rather than unity, pulling us apart rather than helping us see our common nature, our one nature. And that when it arises from generosity and patience and loving kindness and compassion, generosity, selflessness. But when we cling, particularly when we cling to the sense of right and wrong, then it becomes righteous and dangerous. And so how do we move freely within a world of right and wrong without being a person of right and wrong, without creating a self of right and wrong? What does that even mean? How do you love something? How do you care about something without grasping? How do you work towards something that needs to change without becoming the very thing that you're trying to change? We have to look closely. The more we care, the harder it is. The more we're invested, the more self identity there is in it. And so part of what practice is helping us to do is see things as they are, which is to in a sense, see things in their separateness. That love is love. Grasping is grasping. They're not the same. Everything you see embodies it, is not apart from it. In one action, one gesture, one thought, one rolling up, in that moment, is there having, is there not having? Is there right, is there wrong? Although all dualities come from the one, the faith mind says, do not be attached even to this one. And that's very important, because what the one part of the danger of realizing the emptiness of all things, the emptiness of right and wrong, is not understanding that clearly, and then pretending that we live in a world in which there is no right and wrong. So that can lead to denying that there is suffering. Not only is the story not real, the pain isn't real. The pain is real. I feel it. You feel it. It's having consequences. We are having an experience. What isn't real is the web we create around it, is even our perception of that pain. Is that rock inside or outside your mind? When the mind exists undisturbed in the way, nothing in the world can offend. And when a thing no longer can offend, it ceases to exist in the old way. Nothing changes. You're still the same person. The world is still the same world. And that happens in so many moments of practice where we're sitting in a particular kind of realm. Let's call it a hell realm, just for the sake of being able to relate to it. About something that is so present, so overwhelming, so tangible, so real. And then a moment later, or a day later, you can't find it. And you feel pretty good. You know, it's like the first day of session. You know why we don't do Doksan Dice on the first day of session? A lot of unhappy campers. Right? I remember when Dido finally said, he called me and said, I just figured it out. He said, because if I do Doksan, I have to deal with all of the stuff that's happening on the first day. If I just wait a day, most of it's gone. And nothing has changed. But something is not the same. That should raise a question in our mind. What is real? What do we call real? And so when we're right, to not cherish right. When we're wrong, to not hate wrong. One has it, one has not. Right is a moment unto itself. Wrong is a moment unto itself. In the commentary, he talks about how Fayyan failed. Why did he fail, this great master? So one of the things that happens in training, Dada Roshi used to talk about it, he'd say, teacher seeing the student in a cage builds a cage around them. Fayyan, seeing these students entangled in a mind of having and not having, he threw them into the ocean of success and failure. He outed them publicly. One has and one has not. But of course, everybody's implicated. Everybody's wondering. Everybody wants to know. Everybody's in that ocean. Now, the only way through is in. So building a cage around a cage helps us to realize I'm in a cage. In the Surangama Sutra, an important sutra in Mahayana Buddhism, the Buddha was talking to Ananda. And he said, take for instance a square box, a square cage, the inside of which is seen as containing a square of air. Now tell me, is the air seen as square? Is it really square? If so, it should not be round when you pour it into a round box. If not, then there should be no square of air in the box. Is there suffering in that box? Is there embarrassment? Is there shame? Is there arrogance? What is its shape? What is its texture? If it is square, if it is has a certain shape, then it should mean, and it has, and it's real in the way that we experience it as something that just exists, then it should exist no matter where it is. The Buddha says, you say that to Ananda, you say you don't know where the meaning of all this really lies, but the meaning being so, where do you want it to lie? What do you want this to mean? Because meaning doesn't exist out of our wanting. It doesn't exist apart from our wanting. That's why in practice, in Zazen in particular, it's so important when something arises to not invest in the meaning. What do I want this to mean? We don't experience it that way. Normally we experience it as coming with meaning. It means this. This is what it means. It's a self-critical thought. I see something about myself. It means I'm not a good person. It means I'm not very good at this. It means I'm not successful. Where do I want the meaning to lie? He says, if you want the air to be neither square nor round, just throw the box away. More, just realize there is no box. When you don't aren't invested in the meaning, the box has nowhere to, the cage has nowhere to, nothing to wrap around. And so he says in the poem, when they're rolled up, bright and clear is the great emptiness. The light pours through, radiant, illuminating everything. The self is empty. The pain is not real. The suffering is not real. It doesn't exist on its own. It's not a thing. But then he goes on to say, but this great emptiness does not yet come up to our teaching. We're not free yet. Why don't you cast away emptiness in everything? Square, round, air, box. No box, no square. Cast it all away. Then it's all so lucid and perfect, even the wind can't pass through. And so in building a box, Fayyan just says words. One has it, one has not. And the question for the student is, did I just build a box? Fayyan can't do that. I think about this in our life and times in 2019, where right and wrong are on runaway trains. They're being used as clouds and fog and clubs and knives, where love is presented as false affection and wrong is presented as real hatred. There's nothing abstract about this. In fact, that's one of the challenges of practice, is it's more real than we were expecting. Yeah, I want to face reality. No, not this one, though. This was the reality I wanted to face, if you please. We see the incredible power of our mind, of delusion, of a misguided, in a sense we could think of delusion as a misguided, undeveloped spiritual power. It's the same power that we begin to meet and wield and become familiar with and facile with through practice. In a sense, nothing changes and nothing is the same. And we see the incredible power of misguided, undeveloped. And I think we are seeing some very powerful, highly, highly undeveloped people in very important positions who have not studied their mind. And so we stop and turn the light around and examine and take responsibility. When the mind exists undisturbed in the way, that doesn't mean that there's no, it doesn't mean that our, it doesn't match our idea that everything is now peaceful and calm. It's always sunny. It's always 70 degrees. Everyone's always smiling. That's not what it means. What world is that? What does the mind undisturbed mean when the ground is shaking? When your heart is broken, when you want something and you don't succeed, what is the mind undisturbed in that moment? What is peace in that moment? Because that's what the Buddha and the Buddha Dharma is offering. Not controlling the world to match our expectations, but actually finding that peace within ourselves in every moment. And it is the most difficult thing we'll do in our lives. But as the faith mind says, when the mind exists undisturbed in the way, things no longer offend you. And when they no longer offend you, they don't exist in the same way. They still exist, but not in the same way. And we see this in simple ways, in Zazen, in powerful ways, simple and powerful ways, where something that has arisen before again and again and again and has elicited a certain reaction in you, a certain response, that was not a choice, you just reacted, and today it arises, and it's not the same. It is not offending you. The mind is not disturbed. So I'll end with a poem. Rolling up the blinds, stand on the precipice of success and failure. Rolling up the blinds, radiate the ultimate truth. To bring peace to the world, see the world free of your mind's bondage. This mind is originally peaceful, so please, please don't worry. When the mind is free of gain and loss, imperfections cease to disturb. Being undisturbed now, enter the scars of the burning. I will be among the first to admit. Actually, I am not even nearly the first to admit this. This is easy to talk about. It is not easy to do. That's why it is so rarely done. And we need Help. We need help. The Buddha did not do this on his own. He did a great deal drawing from his own resources, but he had help. From the moment he was born, he had help. All of us need help. We call that the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. We call reaching into that help taking refuge. And so, particularly those of you who come for the weekend, whatever direction you take, please take a direction. It's happening, this life thing. It's happening. We're in it. Curtains are drawn, stage is up. We're in the middle of it. And it has consequences. And it has the potential for marvelous, wondrous consequences. This mind, what is it?
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about our ongoing programs and residency opportunities, visit zmm.org.